Well, good evening, everybody. My name is David Everson. I'm a recovered alcoholic.
Hello.
I'm grateful to be here, grateful to be alive and sober and in this sacred place called Alcoholics Anonymous. The program saved my life and many thousands of others before me. I have no illusions that without the help of my creator and Alcoholics Anonymous, I absolutely would not be here today. My sober date is June 24, 2007. And my sponsor is Walter M., and my service sponsor is Wayne Ross. And thank you very much, Denise, for the opportunity and the invitation to come and visit. I really like this group. I love going to recovery-based meetings where the big book is discussed and people share their experience with it. And the Centerside Prayer, too. That was something that I was introduced to early on in recovery, and that helped a lot. And just I was loaded with preconceptions and belief systems that all turned out to be pretty wrong, and all based on my fears and insecurities. So thank you.
You're welcome.
I'm a real alcoholic. What I mean by that is that I suffer from three parts of this disease. One is a spiritual malady that I just feel like I don't fit in, that things just seem to go well for others, but just for some reason not me. Everybody seems to get the rules of life, but I seem to be out of sync, and I'm really uncomfortable and feeling like that's never going to change, feeling like a loser, just feeling sort of disconnected from loving family, from friends, from everything. And it's an uncomfortable place to be, especially when you're a little kid. Growing up on Staten Island, I'm the youngest of six in my family, only alcoholic in the family. But that feeling was there. The second part of that disease is that obsession with alcohol. Once I was introduced to alcohol and started drinking and it ceased to become social drinking, I got more and more looking forward to drinking, that I became obsessed with drinking. That it was the focus of not only my social schedule, it was the focus of my daily schedule. And I could not fathom the idea of going to bed at night without knowing that I had a bottle of wine or a bottle of vodka somewhere in the closet or under the bed or in the trunk of my car to get me through the day, and I could start off right, quote unquote. And the third part is that craving, that once I have a drink, it demands another drink, and demands a third drink, and I just can't stop. And as I've said before, that once my mind tells me to drink, I have no idea what my day is going to look like. And that's scary, too. So that's what helps me understand what an alcoholic is, because all those three areas certainly apply to me. I'm going to hop around a little bit this evening, and we're going to be going from started at page 60 in our big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, which is our text, the program of recovery, to about the middle of page 76. But first, we kind of ended last week and a little bit on step three, but we didn't really talk about that much about step three. So I'd like to start out with right at the beginning, well, I should say the end of the third, fourth page of chapter five of How It Works, where our program, our steps are laid out. Towards the bottom, it says, our description of the alcoholics is on page 60. The chapter to the agnostic in our personal adventures before and after make clear three pertinent ideas. A, that we were alcoholic and could not manage our own lives. I put in parentheses, drunk or sober. B, that probably no human power could have relieved our alcoholism. C, that God could and would if he were sought. Being convinced we were at step three, which is that we decided to turn our will and our life over to God as we understood him. Just what do we mean by that, and just what do we do? The first requirement is that we will be convinced that any life run on self-will can hardly be a success. And I talked about this last week, that in the next page, that description of that actor in the play always trying to make sure everything's right along, if everything goes along to his plan, everything's great. But if there's some changes, then it upsets his apple cart, and then he gets vindictive or angry or this and that, and it's a mess. And I had been encouraged, and I'm glad it was, I was, to every time I talked about that actor all the way through that, to put my name in there, because I could identify with that character on page 61. And that further explained to me clearly that I needed help, because no matter how much I tried to stop drinking on my own, it never lasted more than a few weeks, and I was back. Why? Because of that obsession, and because once I start that craving again, and the spiritual malady. So, hopping to, let's see, on page 62, we covered this a little bit last week too, but this is very key as a basis for step three in a third step prayer. Selfishness and self-centeredness, with that we think is the root of our problems. Driven by 100 forms of fear, self-delusion, self-seeking, self-pity, we step on the toes of our fellows and they retaliate. Sometimes they hurt us, seemingly without provocation, but we invariably find that sometime in the past we have made decisions based on self, which later placed us in a position to be hurt. So, our troubles, we think, are basically of our own making. They arise out of ourselves, and the alcoholic is an extreme example of self-will run riot, although he usually doesn't think so. And it goes on to explain how, as an alcoholic, I must get rid of this self-centeredness, and really a bond. Even though I don't think I have it, it's clear through the as I look at the record of my life and my experience that time after time after time, when I tried to manage things my own way, when I expected everybody else to be doing things my own way, without a drink or with a drink, there were problems. Like I say so many times, it's all about me. And that idea had to be smashed, because it's not all about me. So, it goes on to say a little bit that many of us had moral and philosophical convictions galore, but we could not live up to them even though we would have liked to. Neither could we reduce our self-centeredness much by wishing or trying on our own power. We had to have God's help. This is the how and why of it. First of all, we had to quit playing God. It didn't work. Next, we decided that hereafter, in this drama of life, God was going to be our director. He is the principal. We are his agents. He is the father, and we are his children. Most good ideas are simple, and this concept was a keystone of the new and triumphant arch through which we passed to freedom. My sponsor spent a lot of time with me on that. Mm-hmm. And as I look back, I think clearly he knew where my mind went and ran, and the nature of my alcoholism, about self-will and self-reliance and stubbornness and anger when things didn't go my way, and he had to make it clear to me that really put the mirror up and look at yourself, David. No matter how hard you try, it just doesn't work. And even though I would try and do something, he said, okay, well, and I would explain, he said, well, how'd that work out for you? And invariably, not so well, because of self-will run riot. Just a little bit on page 63. When we sincerely took such a position, all sorts of remarkable things followed. We had a new employer. Being more powerful, he provided what we needed if we kept close to him and performed his work well. Established on such a footing, we became less and less interested in ourselves, our little plans and designs. More and more, we became interested in seeing what we can contribute to life. As we felt new power flow in, we enjoyed peace of mind, as we discovered. Kind of a little bit about that I talked about last week, about how I really enjoyed going to AA meetings early on, because I felt better when I went to AA meetings. Everybody was smiling and welcomed me, of all people, and I felt like I was a part of for that meeting, and I was encouraged, and I had hope. And once I left the meeting, after an hour or two, the little voices are going in my head again, and now I'm coming down again, and everything's a big mess. And as I pointed out last week, I was asked at one point in time, why do you go to AA? Do you go to feel better, or do you want to get better? And I realized that if I want to get better, I need to follow these steps. So I'm thankful for the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, because the fellowship brought me in here. All of you people welcoming me and encouraging me, but you led me to our program of recovery, the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, as outlined in our text here. And that program of recovery brought a shift in my way of thinking, to where it wasn't all about me anymore. and I felt that I could actually pack into the stream of life and be a part of, and it's made all the difference in the world. So now we're on to step three, and I'll read the whole thing. Now we're at step three. Many of us said to our Maker as we understood him, God, I offer myself to thee, to build with me and do with me as thou wilt. Relieve me of the bondage of self, that I may better do thy will. Take away my difficulties, that victory over them may bear witness to those I would help of thy power, thy love, and thy way of life. May I do thy will always. We thought well before taking this step, making sure we were ready, that we could at last abandon ourselves utterly to him. Now, I have a little sidebar here, because I believe in God since I was a little kid. We never went to church because of different religions of my father and my mother, and there were a lot of arguments about church, but we were raised Roman Catholic and went through religious instruction and all that for communion and confirmation, but never went to church. And so I felt separate from God, but I believed in God. So when we got to this point, and one part of me, I didn't have any problem saying the prayer, but in the other part of me, I thought, really doesn't apply to me because God knows I don't go to church. I never have since I was a little kid, and he's mad at me. Mm-hmm. And so it was hard for me to actually, I took the step, but hard for me to actually really take the step in here because of, again, my doubts, my fears, and my belief systems. Little by slowly, that slowly went away. But at first, I said, sure, I'll through that. And my sponsor came over to my house. I was living in a sober house. And it's the first time he came over to my house, the first time we talked face-to-face, because we did this over the phone, because I didn't drive, I didn't have a car. And so he said, call me 10 o'clock Tuesdays and Fridays. And so I did, and we went through these steps over the phone. But he came over to my sober house where I was living to launch me with the third step prayer. And I remember being a little uncomfortable about having a guy in our rec room area and getting on my knees with him and saying the same third step prayer out loud. And I was kind of embarrassed, and it was just really strange because I was not comfortable. I just didn't feel, I mean, in my heart I knew I should be doing this, but I just, there was that self-reliance again, holding back. Fear, mostly. So after the third step prayer, he launched me into the fourth step. He says, right, and you can see it right there on the bottom of page 63. Next, we launch on a course of vigorous action, the first step of which is a personal house cleaning, which many of us had never attempted. Though our decision was a vital and crucial step, it could have little permanent effect once we had followed, unless we had followed a strenuous effort to face and be rid of things in ourselves that have been blocking us. Our liquor was but a symptom. We talked about that last week. That the real problem centers in my mind. The problem is not alcohol. We've heard it a lot. I've certainly heard it a lot in AA. I came in here for my drinking, but I stayed for my thinking. Realizing that the drinking wasn't the problem. It's what's in between my two ears and what my alcoholic mind is always telling me. It'll be different this time. You can have a drink. Go to a different bar. Don't hang out with those people. And it never, ever was, because my mind was always going to take me back to what's killing me. So, therefore, we started upon a personal inventory. This was step four. And I'll read that paragraph, which is the key. And my sponsor actually read this to me because he wanted to make sure I knew how important this was. A little earlier, it says about this was a vital and crucial step. Vital meaning life-giving. And crucial, if I don't do this, there's no hope for me in this program of Alcoholics Anonymous. Earlier on, we talked about rigorous honesty and half measures availing us nothing. That if I was going to do this deal, I had to be all in. And I couldn't be holding back like I was in a third step prayer and just sort of like sticking my foot in the water to see, well, maybe I'll trust God, but sign of any little danger, I'm going to pull back and take back my will, as we used to say. My sponsor would just laugh when I would say that to him. Because he said, you have no power, choice, or control. You have no will to take back. And I'll realize later on he was right. So reading that paragraph. A business that takes no regular inventory usually goes broke. Taking a commercial inventory is a fact-finding and fact-facing process. I underline that. This is an effort to discover the truth about the stock in trade. One object is to disclose damage or unsaleable goods to get rid of them promptly and without regret. If the owner of that business is to be successful, he cannot fool himself about values. I put next to that my values about me. We did exactly the same thing with our lives. We took stock honestly. First, we launched out, we searched out the flaws in our makeup, which caused our failure. Being convinced that self manifested in several ways, in various ways, was what had defeated us, we considered its common manifestations. Resentment is the number one offender. It destroys more alcoholics than anything else. From its stem, all forms of I put my spiritual disease. For we have not been only mentally and physically ill, we have been spiritually sick. When the spiritual malady is overcome, we straighten out mentally and physically. In dealing with resentments, we sent them on paper. We listed people, institutions, or principles with whom we were angry. We asked ourselves why we were angry. In most cases, it was found that our self-esteem, our pocketbooks, our ambitions, our personal relationships, including sex, were hurt or threatened. So we were sore. We were burned up. So that began my instructions for how to begin my fourth step. And we spent a lot of time there. And my sponsor wanted to make it very clear how he wanted to see me proceed with this. He said, get a notebook, a spiral notebook, and I want you to start off on across every single page. God, help me to be fearless, searching, and moral on every single page. Flip it over. God, help me be fearless, searching, and moral. God, help me be fearless, searching, and moral. All through the book before I even put anything down. He wanted that on every single page. And I thought, why are we doing this? And I get to looking later on. The fourth step here, as it's outlined in chapter 5, says, we made a searching and fearless moral inventory. So I guess that makes sense that I should be putting down, God, help me to be searching, fearless, and moral. I'm asking God's help to write this. And he used to say that once I do that, and I mean it, that as I'm searching out these people that I have resentments for and what the cause were and how they affected me, God is helping me write that. And he said he called it a spiritual pen. And it was true in some cases. So I had to look back and realize, yeah, probably never would have written this down or that down if it wasn't for some help from a higher power kind of nudging me to get it on paper. So I went ahead with my list, the name on column one of all these people, and I also included some institutions, the company that my pharmaceutical company for 19 years that fired me, two ex-wives, and he also had me put down God and myself. And so I did. And then next to it was the cause, what those things were that I was mad about. And I went back since I was a little kid, and I thought back early days when I was in PS5 on Staten Island, and I'm the youngest of six, as I mentioned. Well, my folks were pretty old school about how kids dressed for school and what kind of clothes we wore, and so all of my brothers and me had to wear a white shirt and tie to school. This is in the 1950s and 60s. Every single day, starch white shirt and tie. And I hated it. Absolutely hated it. If you think I didn't have a target on my back, you are wrong, because I got picked on and laughed at and made fun of and bullied later on. And boy, I resented my parents for that, for making me do that. And I would argue with them and throw pitch fits and how nobody else at school is wearing a white shirt. You are. And boy, I had a resentment about that. So that was number one, the resentment I got. My mom, my dad, and my mom and dad on a few things. And on it went through childhood, some other things in college, mostly things later on in relationships. And I mentioned already about the job and such, and on the way down through. And I put down what the cause was, what it was, and what it affected in those areas, like self-esteem, or made me feel less than, or affected my security, or personal relations, or what have you. So I went down all as best I could do it. And it took a while, but he gave me about a month. He says, I want you to work on this. And but call me when you're done. So I plugged along, and then I called him. He says, okay, great. All right, now let's start on the next inventory. I said, what do you mean next inventory? He says, well, let's go ahead a little bit. And well, before we get to that, I'm sorry. He says, there's another column I want you to write. In the book here, it talks about three columns. who I'm resentful to or the cause, and it affects mine. But I want you to write a fourth column, my part in it. I said, what do you mean, my part in it? And he says, well, turn the page to page 66. So I did. And he says, we look back to the list, for it held the key to the future. We were prepared to look at it from an entirely different angle. We began to see the world and its people really dominated us. In that state, the wrongdoings of others, fancied or real, had power to actually kill. How could we escape? We saw that those resentments could be mastered, but how? We could not wish them away any more than alcohol. This was our course. We realized that people who wronged us were perhaps spiritually sick. Though they did not like their symptoms and the way that they disturbed us, they, like ourselves, were sick too. We asked God to help us show them the same tolerance, pity, and patience that we would cheerfully grant a sick friend. When a person is offended, we said to ourselves, this is a sick man. How could I be helpful to him? God save me from being angry. This thy will be done. We avoid retaliation or argument. We wouldn't treat sick people that way. If we do, we destroy our chance of being helpful. We cannot be helpful to all people, but at least God will show us how to take a kindly and tolerant view of each and every one. So referring to that list again, here's that fourth column. Putting out of our minds the wrong others had done, we resolutely looked for our own mistakes. Where had we been selfish, dishonest, self-seeking, and frightened? Though the situation had not been entirely our fault, we tried to disregard the other person involved entirely. Where were we to blame? The inventory was ours, not the other man's. When we saw our faults, we listed them. We placed them before us in black and white. We admitted our wrongs, and honestly, we were willing to set matters straight. So I tried to do that, and I took a lot of time. And that situation with my parents about being so resentful about them, about the white shirt and tie for 8 years of grammar school and all that, all I could pretty much come up with was pretty lame. I said, well, I should have been a better son. Well, that's not very much. But that's pretty much what I could muster at that time. But there were some other things where I could see that I had fueled some of the resentments that I had, these things that I was mad at people back from when I was a kid. Just bear in mind, resentments, if we've got them, if I've got them, and if they go back that far, it feels like it just happened yesterday, even though it might have been 40 years ago, because something was hurt inside me, and that's not right. I'm half Irish, and my sister sometimes says that she hopes that when the time, and she is too, of course, but she hopes when the time comes that she doesn't get Irish Alzheimer's. And I said, what's that? She says, well, forget everything but the grudges. I hope that's not me. So, now I finished my fourth column. He said, now we get to this second inventory, which is the fear inventory. And he had me write down a list of all the things I was afraid of. Just run with it. Take your time, be calm, quiet, and put them all down. And I did. You know, fear of heights, and fear of being alone, fear of failure, fear of disapproval, fear of success, fear. Some of them contradicted each other, but I put them all down. And I went back, and I probably had about 18 or 20 of them, and to take them one by one. Why do I have this fear? Why do I have this fear of heights? Well, because I'm afraid I'm going to fall down. Well, why do you have a fear about that? Well, because I'm going to get hurt. Well, why do you have a fear about that? And he had me walk it all the way through with all these fears that I had. Why did I have them? Why do I have them? And bringing it all down to the least common denominator, it mattered. It all boiled down to self-reliance was failing me. I was afraid of things that I could not control. There again, there's that third step where I'm going to be asking God for his guidance and control and turning my life over, that things are okay, and also about me taking my will back when my foot's in the water and I don't like things and it's not going my way. Well, not so fast. Pull it back again. Self-reliance failing me. And I put on the back, on the top of page 69, it's a marvelous quote, but it's not from anybody in the big book, but I heard it when I was at a big book seminar once, and it had to do with this. I said, when I'm not trusting and relying on God and God to care for me, it's all about me again. Which is true. I can see that in myself. So I went through my fear inventory. And he says, all right, now we'll start on the sex inventory. And he had me and work with me on the phone about this. And this is on the bottom of page 68. He says, now about sex. Many of us needed an overhauling there. But above all, we try to be sensible on this question. It's so easy to get way off track. Here we find human opinions running to extremes. Absurd extremes, perhaps. One set of voices cry that sex is a lust for the lust of our lower nature, a bare necessity for procreation. Then we have the voices that cry for sex and more sex, who bewail the institutions of marriage, who think that most of the troubles of the race are traceable to sex causes. They think that we do not have enough of it, or is it the right kind? They see its significance everywhere. One school would allow men no flavor to his fare, and the other would have us all on a straight pepper diet. We want to stay out of this controversy. We do not want to be the arbiter of anyone's sex conduct. We all have sex problems. We'd hardly be human if we didn't. But what can we do about them? And here's my instructions. We reviewed our conduct. Well, hang on, back up. My sponsor said, all right, on your sex inventory, I want you to take out that notepad again and list all the relationships you've had, even if they were just one night stand or a long-term relationship or a platonic relationship, you name it. I want it all down there. And so I started, and I put down the name of the person, and my instructions were, after the name of the person, you know, who it was, what was the nature of that relationship, what was my motive for being involved. So I'd write that down. What sort of things came up during that relationship, and how did it end? And I started writing all that down. And I had about 18, I think. And there's this pattern that started to emerge, that my controlling and my pressuring and my lust and my manipulation, and it all just came coming through. And in many, many cases, what topics came up was my drinking. Would you please stop drinking? I'm concerned about you. You drink too much. I'm worried about you. And I would, of course, fight against that and all. But I could see a pattern there. And no wonder those relationships didn't go well. Not only with the opposite sex, but with family members as well. But always self-will, trying to do things my own way, having it blow up in my face, and yet not taking any solution because I got this, right? So I went through all that on that sex inventory, and now we got to get to the part where he handed me an 8.5 by 11 sheet of paper, and it had some questions printed on it. There were 9 questions, and he says, I want you to apply these 9 questions to each one of those people on that sex inventory. And I thought, well, this is kind of odd because I thought we're going out of the big book, you know, as things were in the big book. And here I have something outside of the big book. So this is what he had me do. He said, right, had I been selfish? Where had I been dishonest? Where had I been inconsiderate? Whom did I hurt? Family, etc. Not just the person, but did I hurt anyone else? Her children, what have you? Did I unjustifiably arouse jealousy, suspicion, bitterness? Where was I at fault? What should I have done instead? And don't take the easy way out and say, never gone out with her. But what should you have done instead? And later on, I take a look at that, and it's all right there on page 69, all those 9 questions. So we were going right out of the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. I just didn't know it. So I got through that. And now I start being the obsessive compulsive person that I am. I got to make sure everything's neat, and I'm rewriting my, you know, so it's all presentable because I have lousy handwriting, and I'm really just stalling. And finally my sponsor called me up one day. He says, where are you with the fourth step? I said, well, I'm getting there. He says, well, wrap it up. Let's meet next week. So, okay. So brings us to our Chapter 6, Into Action. Just a little bit here, about 3 pages. But this is where we're going into I'm going into my 5th step with my sponsor. Correct? Yeah. We made an appointment. Now, this is the second time my sponsor's been to my house. all the other times were on the phone, or I would see him at meetings or what have you. And I'm nervous, and I'm pacing, and I'm just sweating bullets, and I'm really uncomfortable about this because, one, is I'm afraid. I'm uncomfortable because I don't feel right about all these things I've written down. I don't feel right about sharing that with another human being, things that I would rather keep just under the cover of darkness, and I'd rather wish no one would know. But it was made very clear to me that if I want to get well, this needs to be done. I had to be rid of the things that are blocking me. And so I said, okay, let's do it. So I'm waiting, and I look in the backyard, and there's his car, and he's sitting out there, and I wonder, what's he doing out there? And he's been out there for a while. And after a little while, he comes and he knocks on the door. So I invite him in, and we find a quiet spot that we can, you know, sit down and not be, you know, disturbed or anything. And so he says, okay. He had a notebook with him, a notepad and a pen. He says, first of all, let's pray. And he prayed, seeking God's guidance as he helped me. It was going to take this step, you know, this fifth step. And he says, all right, David, what I'd like you to do is I'd like you to read. Now, you can see I have a pen and paper here. As you're reading, I might be moved to just jot down some notes, or I might pause and ask you for more clarification or something like that. But just pretty much just disregard me. Just read. I want to hear you read your entire fourth step, everything from soup to nuts, from those resentments all the way through. So I'm starting, and I'm reading along. And a couple times he stops me for clarification and all. And at one point he says, whoa, wait a minute here. There you are, the victim, again. I said, what? He said, well, here, you're the victim here. Here, go back a few pages. You're talking about your parents and back in grade school and having to wear the white shirt and tie and how strict they were, and that was your resentment. He says, you're the victim there. And I thought, yeah, I guess so. And then over here, and he could see patterns. And I could see the patterns now, too. Like, yeah. He says, okay, go ahead. So I went on and read and went through the whole thing. And when we were done, he says, all right, what I have here is I just felt led to jot some things down. Is I made a list. And these are what, from what you've shared, these are what I sense to be some of your character defects. And I'm going to hand you the list. And you can either add to them or take away from them, or you're going to throw it away. But this is what came to me. So I took them, and I keep a copy of that in my big book all the time. And this is what came out to him. Attention-seeking, lust, victim, manipulative, ego, prideful, dishonest, controlling, pushy, self-reliant, impatient. There's about 7-8 things there. And I thought, my goodness, that's me. How did he know? But just by listening and what I was going on, he could see patterns, and this is me. These are the things about my personality that certainly are not very attractive and don't cause people to want to spend time with me. And if I want to be a part of life and in society, these are the things I need to address. And he's absolutely right. So he says, all right, it's done with that. But then he gave me instructions for what to do after we've finished the fifth step. He says, when you go home, I want you to find a place where you can be quiet for an hour, carefully reviewing what we've done. And thank God from the bottom, I'll just read the whole thing. Thank God from the bottom of our heart for that we know him better. Taking this book down from the shelf, we turn to the page which contains the 12 steps. Carefully reading the first 5 proposals, we ask that we have admitted anything, for we are building an arch. There's that arch again, through which we shall walk a free man at last. Is our work solid so far? Are the stones properly in place? Have we skimped on the cement put under the foundation? Have we tried to make mortar without sand? A review of those first 5 steps. And before he left, we said a little prayer together, and I just felt this. I felt like I was on top of the world. Mm. All of that stuff that I was afraid of, I mean, it was just gone. And I found out later on, much later on, when he was sitting out in the car, he was praying. He was asking God's guidance to help him be of service to me. To me, the sponsee. I didn't know that. That fifth step experience is something that I always look back and really treasure, because for a man to take that time to work with me and to help me be rid of this that is killing me, out of a sincere desire of helping to share what he has with me, has made such a tremendous difference. So he said, after that hour, that's what I want you to do. He says, now, sometimes people hold things back, because this is a daunting task going through this inventory with someone. He says, if you're moved, if things pop up over the next couple of days that there's something you want to discuss, just call me. And sure enough, there was at least one thing that came to mind that I was on the phone with him, and I said, you know, Pete, there's one other thing that I need to tell you about. And he says, okay, what is it? And I'm nervous, and I wouldn't have told him. He says, oh, I have no judgment with you about that. Just take it to God. It's good. All good. I'm like, wow. I thought he was going to say, you what? You know, nothing. Not at all. Just no judgment at all. And there again, another weight, you know, coming off. So that was my fifth step experience. I look back now, and it says right here on page 75 this is where we go into the fifth step. We pocket our pride and go to it, illuminating every twist of character, every dark cranny of the past. But now that was over. Once we have taken this step, withholding nothing, we are delighted. And I was. We can look the world in the eye, and I could. We could be alone at perfect peace and ease. And I was. Our fears fall from us. We begin to feel the nearness to our Creator. We may have had certain spiritual beliefs, but now we're beginning to have a spiritual experience. And I was. So this fifth step, this fourth and fifth step, was life-changing for me. One more indication of how Alcoholics Anonymous saved my life. So that's what I have for this evening, and I hope I brought a good message, and I look forward to hearing your input. Thank you. Peace.
Thank you.